From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
3,000 U.S. police departments authorized the use of pepper spray. And we know that since 1990, more than 60 people in the United States have died in police custody.
Torture, electroshock, and chain gangs. Today, an extended conversation with the Secretary General of Amnesty International, Pierre Sane, on human rights abuses, no, not in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, but in the United States of America.
Like a chokehold or hope tying, which have been reported in several police departments from Athens, Georgia, to Lansing, Michigan, or Los Angeles.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The House Judiciary Committee yesterday approved launching a formal impeachment inquiry against President Clinton, only the third such investigation of a U.S. president in history. The Republican majority panel on a party-line 21-16 vote took the first step toward an open-ended, unrestricted probe of Clinton that eventually could range far beyond his affair with former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. The inquiry, which must be approved by the full 435-member House later this week, would be the first presidential impeachment proceeding since Richard Nixon's Watergate scandal in 1974. The Republican motion does not set a deadline for ending the probe and would allow it to move beyond Lewinsky to issues such as Whitewater, campaign finance abuses, or the White House travel office firings. Democrats, whose proposal for a restricted probe with a firm deadline was rejected on a party-line vote, said the investigation's open-ended structure would subject the country to a prolonged and gut-wrenching impeachment process. Even as it plans for NATO military action, the United States is considering the possible deployment of troops to Kosovo, but no decisions have been made. This, according to U.S. officials quoted in Reuters news wires today. There are also reports that the USS Eisenhower and its wing of 48 strike fighters, as well as a missile-armed battle group, could lead a possible airstrike against Yugoslavia. The House voted yesterday to permit the Clinton administration to spend nearly $100 million on military aid for opponents of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, with the goal to topple him from power. The legislation does not require the administration to act or change U.S. policy of containment in Iraq. In addition to the up to $97 million it permits in shipments of U.S. weapons and other military equipment, it also allows $2 million in funding for opposition groups for radio and television broadcasts into Iraq. Although it's not binding on the White House, the Iraqi government last week condemned it as interference in its internal affairs. Israeli F-16 fighters have reportedly been equipped to carry chemical and biological weapons manufactured at a secret biological institute near Tel Aviv. A British newspaper says the institute supplied poison for an attempt last year to kill a leader of the Islamic fundamentalist group Hamas. The Sunday Times says Israeli agents sprayed the poison into the leader's ear, but Israel supplied an antidote after Jordan threatened to put the agents on trial. Last week, the Israeli Prime Minister's office acknowledged that an El Al cargo plane that crashed in an Amsterdam residential area in 1992 was carrying a chemical which can be used to make the nerve gas sarin. The Israeli government has called inaccurate reports the institute makes chemical and biological weapons. China today lashed out at the U.S. Congress for approving funding which would integrate Taiwan into an Asia-Pacific missile defense umbrella. A foreign ministry spokesperson said China is deeply concerned parts of the 1999 State Department authorization bill would extend a controversial theater missile defense system to Taipei and authorize continued arms sales to the island. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson called today for the release of all political prisoners held in Burma and urged the military government to halt its repression of the opposition. In a bluntly worded statement, Robinson said she'd raised issues including forced labor and the forced displacement of ethnic minorities with Burma's foreign minister in New York in September and had received no satisfactory response. Robinson also called on the Burmese leadership to have a dialogue with the opposition on national reconciliation and allow the independent UN human rights investigator on the country to make a fact-finding visit. Indonesia said today it will not allow a referendum on independence for East Timor and that the dispute over Timor would remain deadlocked unless Portugal accepts Indonesia's proposals to settle the issue. And a federal appeals court cleared the way yesterday for the release of FBI documents wanted by an Oklahoma grand jury investigating the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people. Attorneys for Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols argued that releasing the documents could jeopardize their rights to a fair trial at the state level or at the federal level if they won new trials. The decision permits the release of 25,000 FBI reports and allows FBI agents to testify in any state proceeding. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
Three white men came to my cell, and one of them was a state highway patrolman because he was wearing a little silver plate across his pocket that said John L. Bassinger. And he asked me where I was from, and I told him I was from Louisville. And he said, I'm going to check that. And he went out, and I guess he called Louisville, and they didn't like me in Louisville because I worked with voter registration there. And when he came back, he said, you damn right. He said, you're from Louisville, all right. And we gonna make you wish you was dead. And they led me out of that cell into another cell. And he gave a Negro prisoner a blackjack. And he ordered me to lay down on a bunk bed. And a Negro prisoner said, do you want me to beat her with this, sir? And he said, you damn right. Because if you don't, you know what I'll do for you. And I laid down on the bunk like he ordered me to do. And the first Negro beat me. He beat me until he was exhausted. And after he beat, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. And during the time he was beating, I began to work my feet because that was a horrible experience. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro that had beat to sit on my feet while the second one beat. And I just began to scream where I couldn't control it. And then the white man got up and began to beat me in my head. I have a blood clot now in the artery to the left eye and a permanent kidney injury on the right side from that beating.
Fannie Lou Hamer, famed civil rights activist, speaking in the 1960s about her treatment by U.S. authorities. Today she would have been 81 years old, born October 6, 1917. Well, she's describing the 1960s in the South. Today we look at the whole United States of America in 1998. Amnesty International is releasing a report today that documents a persistent and widespread pattern of human rights violations in the U.S. The group is also launching a worldwide campaign against human rights abuses here. It's the first time since Amnesty International was founded in 1961 that the more than 350,000 Amnesty members from the U.S. are participating in a campaign aimed at their own country. Amnesty International published its first report on the United States' justice in the American South in 1965 and has published hundreds of reports on the U.S. since then. The report being released today, called Rights for All, highlights widespread police brutality, physical and sexual violence against prisoners, imprisonment of asylum seekers, and the U.S. government's refusal to sign on to and abide by numerous U.N. conventions, including the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The report also documents how U.S. foreign policy contributes to human rights abuses in other countries. We're joined right now by Secretary General of Amnesty International, Pierre Sané. He's the primary spokesperson for Amnesty, representing the movement to governments, international organizations, and the general public. Pierre Sané, tell us what you found.
One of the learning that can be derived from our monitoring of the human rights situation in the United States since the 70s is that there is a general failure of the systems of monitoring and accountability for the police, for prison guards, and for immigration officials. The standards, the human rights standards in the USA have not kept pace with the evolving international standards of decency, to the extent that today what exists in international human rights protects better people in other countries where governments have ratified international conventions and abide by those conventions. The human rights violations that we document in this report are in no way exhaustive. They do not cover all situations of human rights violations. For instance, they do not cover violations of social, economic, and cultural rights. They do not cover situations of domestic violence where the state fails to bring to court those who are responsible for this pattern of abuse. It focuses on four key issues. One is police brutality. The second one is the violations in the prisons and in the jails. The third one is the treatment of asylum seekers who are treated like criminals. And finally, we look at the use of the death penalty, which we continue to define as arbitrary, unfair, and racist. And finally, we look at foreign policy and human rights, because the United States claims for itself to be a champion of human rights abroad. But what we document in our report is that the policy stand very often has been selective and has been inconsistent.
Pierre Sané, before we get to the details of the report, why did you decide to focus on the United States?
Well, this year, 1998, is the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. 50 years ago, the world community, in response to the atrocities committed in Nazi Germany, came together and said, never again. Came together and said, in order to build a world that will be based on peace and justice, there was a need to agree by consensus certain minimum standard of behavior for all governments vis-a-vis their citizens and also vis-a-vis each other. And those standards are called human rights. In 1948, governments who drafted the declaration, the 56 government who drafted the declarations, committed themselves to protect the rights of their citizens, to promote human rights at home and abroad. One of the key actors in the development of international human rights standard is the United States of America. This year, we are commemorating 50 years of development of international standards, 50 years of the growth of the human rights movement, 50 years of the centrality of human rights in the relationship between state and society and in the relationship between governments. It is ironic that the most powerful nation on earth, which claims for itself this mantle of champion of human rights on a global plane, is failing its own citizen and is not guaranteeing equal protection for all its citizens. After 50 years of efforts, we are now entering into a new period where we think that the Declaration of Principles, the development of international instruments, are not enough in and by themselves. What is needed now is action. We are moving into a world that is more and more turbulent, a world where the conflicts are on the increase, where economic insecurity is on the increase. And whenever in previous period of history we have gone through similar tensions, it has led to major conflict among nations. We think that it is not only important for all government to rededicate themselves to the principles contained in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but to take action urgently in order to ensure that those principles are transformed into a reality. We think that the United States, as an important and key member of the international community has to ensure that its own house is in order.
We're talking to Pierre Sané, Secretary General of Amnesty International, which has both simultaneously launched an international campaign around human rights in the United States and released a report today in the United States called Rights for All. Pierre Sané, you have a chapter on the issue of police brutality, something that's getting more attention in the United States, although I think really just among certain sectors of society, and there is a growing movement against it. What did you find? What did Amnesty International find in a systematic way looking at police brutality?
We found that throughout the country, too many officers display a propensity to use unnecessary, violent, and brutal means. The violence is either unreported or is covered up by a code of silence that exists among officers. We find that the investigation on the complaints is inadequate, and we find that there is a lack of prosecution. Most of the victims of the police brutality are members of ethnic minorities, young African Americans, young Latino Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans. And we think that unless the police is supervised by civilian systems that will allow adequate accountability, that will allow monitoring of the complaints, and unless those bodies are adequately resourced, adequately staffed, and given sufficient authority, it will be difficult to ensure that the police is respectful of the rights of all in this country.
You talk about standard of conduct for police officers set out under the UN Code of Conduct for Law Enforcement Officials and the UN Basic Principles on the Use of Force and Firearms by Law Enforcement Officials as being violated across this country. You've got a picture, for example, of Abner Louima, the Haitian immigrant who suffered serious internal injuries after New York police officers allegedly beat him and rammed a toilet plunger up his rectum. You talk about Los Angeles, how two official inquiries into policing have found a serious problem of excessive use of force, including beatings and unjustified shootings by patrol officers perpetrated mainly against members of minority groups. Philadelphia, the police department, drug squad officers operating mainly in a poor black neighborhood, accused systematically of beating and robbing suspects, planting drugs, and falsifying reports. What are the recommendations of Amnesty International around these violations?
Yes, we also talk of Atlanta. We talk of Detroit. We talk of Chicago. Really, the pattern of police brutality, of abuses by the police, is throughout the country. It is large cities, it is small rural town, and the cases that we have put forward in the document is just an illustration. It is just really the tip of the iceberg. The recommendations that we are formulating, some of them actually have started being implemented. It is unfortunate that they are only implemented after a major scandal, after a public outcry. That is where politicians start to take action. What we would like to see, first of all, is a compilation of the data regarding police brutality. It's very difficult to have a comprehensive view of exactly what is happening. We would like to see the Justice Department compile and publish detailed national data on police use of force with the analysis of the patterns. That will allow the formulation of policies to address that. Secondly, the police force can only police the society that it finds. And in a society where racism and injustice are entrenched, it is very likely that those who will suffer from police brutality, from abuse of power, will be those who are already discriminated against in society. Racial discrimination should be eliminated. And then when these abuses take place, what is needed is serious investigation. What is needed is the sanctioning of those police officers who commit these abuses. What is needed is the prosecution of those police officers. It is this climate of impunity, police officers believing that they are above the law, that they can treat suspects in ways that are illegal, in ways that are violent, where they use unnecessary force. It is this climate of impunity which encourages this practice and these patterns.
Pierre Sané, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Pierre Sané, Secretary General of Amnesty International, which releases its report today, Rights for All, United States of America. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest for this hour is Pierre Sané. He is Secretary General of Amnesty International. He's been the Secretary General for the last 6 years, appointed in 1992. He's originally from Senegal, has been in charge of major reports that Amnesty International has put out around Israel and the occupied territories and the Palestinian Authority, Mexico, South Africa, Peru, and Colombia. Has met with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, has addressed the UN Security Council, now again taking on the United States of America around the issue of human rights in a very comprehensive report called Rights for All. In a while, we're going to talk about what the actual campaign will consist of around the United States and around the world. And again, I want to stress that what's so unusual about this is that usually people who are part of Amnesty International in any one country do not work on an issue in their own country, but in another one. Here, there is an exception, and the 350,000 members of Amnesty International in the United States will be allowed to work on the United States. Well, let's continue on the issue of methods the police use, like electroshock, like pepper spray, like illegal chokeholds, and what you found, whether this is increasing, the kinds of cases that they're used in, and how you think that pressure is going to be put on U.S. authorities to change these police practices.
All international standards in human rights protection, in the use of force by the police on the treatment of prisoners, insist that the police, in restraining offenders or in restraining suspects, should use really the minimum force and should use force only when it is really necessary. And we have found again and again cases of use of this new technology that he's developing. For instance, 3,000 U.S. police departments authorized the use of pepper spray. And we know that since 1990, more than 60 people in the United States have died in police custody after being exposed to pepper spray. And in the document, in the report, we give some example. The same, some of the police restraints, which are dangerous, result in death, like chokehold or hog tying, which have been reported in several police departments from Athens, Georgia, to Lansing, Michigan, or Los Angeles. We would like really the Justice Department to undertake a thorough investigation on the implications and the results of the use of all those techniques, including stun belts, including stun gun, to see whether they are in line with international standards. Many countries have banned the use of those methods because they have proved to be lethal. Many continue to insist that these are less than lethal methods, but methods which are less than lethal but which continue to inflict death should lead us to think again.
Hog tying may surprise some in this country and around the world that that goes on in the United States and that it's actually legal in some cases. It's interesting, Pierre Sané, to look at the beginning pages of your report where you have a map of the United States, and you, in that map, you mark every state in terms of practices that Amnesty International condemns, in terms of practices that, well, international law condemns. It's a very useful map to look at the geographic distribution of human rights concerns. And hog tying is actually one of the examples you use, and you show deaths by hog tying. And I'm looking here to see in which state this has occurred. Among the states, California, Maryland, Georgia, Texas, Oklahoma. It is a lot more common than people might expect. Mississippi, etc. Can you talk about this map? I actually think this is a very useful guide for activists in this country. Could you go through the human rights concerns that you have marked in each of the states?
What we show there is probably the tip of the iceberg. This is based on information that we have collected, that we have checked, obviously. The fact that we do not indicate a certain type of violation in one state doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. It only means that it didn't come to our attention. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the map of the United States, you see that the concern regarding human rights violation, which is police brutality, which is ill treatment in prison, asylum seekers treated as prisoners, death penalty, you see that we have concerns everywhere. And therefore, the response has to come not just from the federal government, but also from state authorities, has to come also from municipalities and police departments. What is worrying, of course, is the increasing use of all these electronic gadgets that have been developed to incapacitate suspects, to incapacitate prisoners, and which has led to several deaths. Very often, at the international level, when people think about human rights violations in the United States, they think about the south of the country. And what the maps show is that it is not the case. Yes, the south is dotted with all kinds of stars and spots, etc. But you find human rights violations in Maine, in Minnesota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, Montana, Washington, Ohio, Iowa, Nebraska, etc.
Other practices that you talk about in the report are the hitching rail. I'm looking at a photograph on page 63. In Alabama, prisoners have been tied to a restraint pole known as the hitching rail as punishment, sometimes for hours in sweltering heat or freezing conditions. At Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama, inmates have been handcuffed to the rail for up to a day. In January 97, a federal magistrate ruled the state should stop using the rail, describing it as painful and tortuous punishment. However, a state appeal against the ruling was still pending in July of 1998. Now, that picture goes along with a whole section you have on sexual abuse and, in general, on how women and pregnant women are treated in prison. What did you find there?
We have found some horrible stories, really, that shock the conscience of, that would shock the conscience of any American. Women in labor who are shackled just before giving birth. I mean, we can understand that a dangerous prisoner can be shackled in order to avoid the prisoner from causing harm to others or for causing harm to himself or herself. But a woman who is pregnant, who is in labor, who is about to give birth, being shackled, these are the kind of information that we unearth when we do the research and which seems to be just quite natural. It's the procedure. And this is the kind of things that we would like really the Justice Department to address, to investigate, to see really what is the spread of this practice. Because this practice is really clearly inhumane. How can you shackle a woman who is in labor? It's really very difficult to understand. I don't think I've seen this in any other country that we have covered. I mean, the giving birth is I think it's something that in all culture is respected, irrespective of who is giving birth. But putting those women who are giving birth in this situation is just, I must admit, beyond comprehension as far as I'm concerned.
And you talk about prison and jail violence, including rape and sexual assault, that so often women and more often men are exposed to.
Yes. What is also strange in this country is that women prisoners are supervised by male guards, and there have been many instances of sexual abuse of women prisoners by guards, and guards actually selling the women for sexual favors to male prisoners. And this is against international standards. International standards clearly stipulate that women prisoners should be guarded by female guards, or at least when you have male guards, that they should be accompanied by female guards. But this is not the case. And another surprise is that you still have states, I think eight of them, which have no laws criminalizing sexual relations between staff and inmates in prisons. And those include Alabama, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Montana, Virginia, Washington, and West Virginia. You have today in the United States 75,000 women in prison. That number has multiplied by 10 since the 80s. Many of them are there for non-violent crimes, mainly related to drug use and drug trafficking, and they find themselves in a situation more and more difficult, degrading, where they are assaulted and where they are not protected from sexual misconduct.
Again, we are talking with Pierre Sanet, Secretary General of Amnesty International. It's interesting that in the map of human rights concerns reflected in the report that Amnesty has put out, Rights for All, You also include, in a state-by-state breakdown, legislation criminalizing consensual sexual acts between adults of the same sex. Now, this isn't about prison, but this in general is about the anti-sodomy laws in the United States.
Amnesty International campaigns for human rights for all, and we oppose any criminalization of sexual acts between consenting adults in private, and any person who is imprisoned because of his or her sexual orientation becomes a prisoner of conscience in Amnesty International.
Pierre Sene, can you talk a little about the decision of Amnesty International to allow members of Amnesty in the United States to work on an issue within their own country, in this case in the United States? I don't know if people are aware of Amnesty's practice generally of saying that members of Amnesty cannot work on their own country, but have to work on other countries. But here you've suspended that rule.
Yes, there are recent development in Amnesty International, especially since the end of the Cold War and since the beginning of all these conflicts around the world. We are saying that international pressure can assist for a time, but what will bring the changes in the human rights situation in the different country is the pressure from below. And we want to join with other human rights organizations in the different countries to organize that pressure from below and combine that pressure from below with the pressure from outside to force the government to bring the necessary changes. We have therefore made certain adjustments in our policies by allowing Amnesty members in the countries where we have serious concern to join the rest of the human rights community in that country in campaigning for changes in legislation, in campaigning to raise awareness, in campaigning to promote human rights. The International Secretariat will continue to retain the responsibility for the research, for documenting the cases, for selecting the individual cases around which Amnesty members will be mobilized. But all sections of Amnesty, especially in the case of this campaign, will join with the USA campaign in promoting changes in the United States. And we see this very much as a continuum following our campaign on the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The campaign on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says all human rights for all, and the campaign on the United States is rights, all rights for everybody in the U.S. So our members will be using this opportunity to raise awareness in their respective communities about the failures of the U.S. government when it comes to its international obligations, about the hypocrisy of the foreign policy, the selectivity of the foreign policy, and the need for people to not to be complacent and to mobilize, to put pressure on the political leaders to ensure that the House will be in order.
And what are you recommending? What is Amnesty recommending groups do around the country?
Amnesty members in the U.S. will join with Amnesty members worldwide. So the first objective of any campaign that we undertake is to raise awareness. We believe that it is important that people are informed and in the process are also educated about rights and obligations of all governments, but also of individuals. We, as individuals worldwide, have to take action. We are also responsible. This world is the world that that we make. We are all actors. So we invite all communities, we invite all people to join us in this campaign, not just to raise awareness, but also to put pressure and target the politicians so they can put pressure on their representative, they can on their representative in Congress. There will be election in next month. It will be a good opportunity to question the candidates regarding their human rights agenda. There will be presidential election in a year, in a little bit more than a year, but the campaign will start soon. This will be again a good opportunity to question and challenge the political parties and the candidates on their human rights agenda, and to get from them a commitment to bring the necessary changes and introduce the legislation that will ensure that the U.S. will abide by the international obligations that it has contributed in writing together with other nations.
Pierre Sané, we have to break once again to have our stations identify themselves, but when we come back with you, we want to talk about the United States exporting torture and torture devices abroad. Pierre Sané, Secretary General of Amnesty International, which has just released a report on the United States called Rights for All, United States of America. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, still with our guest, Pierre Sané, who is here in the United States holding a news conference today in Washington, releasing the report, Rights for All, United States of America. It is an unprecedented report and campaign that Amnesty International is launching beginning today for a year around human rights abuses in the United States. And at the end of the report is a chapter on human rights and U.S. arms called Out of Control. Can you talk, Pierre Sané, about the issue of U.S. arms, about covert supply operations, about surplus weapons, about training of foreign soldiers on U.S. soil?
In terms of international obligations that governments, members of the world community have, not only are they obliged to protect and promote human rights at home by ratifying international instruments, bringing the changes to their national legislation in order to reflect the evolving standards of decency, ensuring the rule of law, and investigating and prosecuting all abuses of human rights, but they also have a duty to refrain from contributing to human rights abuses abroad. They have to promote human rights internationally, and they have to refrain from contributing to human rights violations in other countries. And here again, the record of the United States is really a mixed record. Obviously, we appreciate any initiative that the U.S. government takes in order to promote human rights in other countries, initiatives that they take to obtain the release of prisoners of conscience, to end torture in other countries. But at the same time, it is very difficult to reconcile this commitment to the promotion of human rights internationally with the supply of weaponry and security equipment, with the provision of training to some of these governments who have been responsible for terrible abuses of their own citizens. For instance, the United States provides helicopters, armored personnel carriers, trucks and jet fighters to Turkey, where the government is using it against Turkish villages where human rights violations have occurred. The USA is exporting thousands of stun guns to countries where we have documented electroshock torture, including Argentina, Indonesia, Mexico, Saudi Arabia. The USA has granted export licenses for rifles, small arms, pistols, revolvers, ammunition, etc., to country with record of persistent human rights abuse, and those include Bahrain, Bolivia, Colombia, Egypt, Mexico, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey. And in terms of military training, people are now familiar with the School of the America in Fort Benning, Georgia, where I'm sure that many of the alumni have a terrible record in terms of gross human rights violations. So this policy is really undermining the credibility of the United States when it then claims that it wants to promote human rights abroad. The people, the general population who suffer abuses in the hands of their government with weapons and technical expertise provided by the U.S. cannot take seriously the United States when, on the other hand, it claims that it has concerns regarding the standard of human rights obtaining in those countries. We believe that the U.S., like the European Union, like South Africa, for instance, should develop codes of conduct, should ensure that the process of licensing and exporting of arms is really transparent, should ensure itself that the end users will not transfer those weaponry to unintended clients in the beginning. And very often we find ourselves in a situation where those who initially received weaponry by the U.S. turn out after that to turn those weapons against U.S. interests. We know that in Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion, U.S. covert operation have included the support of the armed opposition group. We know that in Angola, the U.S. covert operation have included support to UNITA, including the provision of weapons and the training of forces responsible for large-scale human rights abuses. And many of these weapons are given away.
Could you talk, I want to end up on the death penalty, but could you talk about how juveniles are treated in the United States, and maybe you can link that overall to the International Treaty on the Rights of the Child?
International human rights law define as children anybody under the age of 18. And the International Covenant on the Right of the Child specifically prohibits the execution of juvenile offenders because they are not considered to be really legally responsible. Only two countries in the world have not ratified the Convention on the Right of the Child. One is the United States of America, and the other one is Somalia, which is in no position to enter into any form of treaty with other states because the state has collapsed. So we can say that technically the United States is the only country in the world not to have ratified the Convention on the Right of the Child. And why? Because the United States wants to continue to execute offenders who committed the crime when they were children. there are only 6 countries in the world today known to have executed juveniles. Apart from the United States, you have Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. And really, this is not, I think, a company that the U.S. Citizens want to keep when it comes to human rights. I think that it shows that cruelty is not something that happens only elsewhere, but it does also happen in the United States. As we speak, there is a juvenile that whose execution has been scheduled to take place, next week in Virginia. And not only is that prisoner being sentenced to death for a crime he committed when he was 17, but also that prisoner has shown signs of mental retardation. Executing mentally retarded people is something that the international human rights instruments prohibit as well. We believe that the death penalty is a violation of the right to life. The death penalty is a human rights issue, and this is something that the political leaders in this country have to come to grips with. 100 countries in the world today have abolished the death penalty in law and in practice. The United Nations Commission on Human Rights, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and as we are moving towards the 21st century, has passed a resolution calling for a moratorium on execution so that we can move towards a world where execution will be totally abolished. We think that the death penalty will continue to haunt the conscience of the American political leaders, and as the world is steadily moving towards abolition, the United States will find itself really in a company of some of the states whose human rights record is difficult to emulate otherwise.
Pierre Sene, one of the people who have gotten a tremendous amount of attention around the issue of the death penalty is Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is in prison on death row in Pennsylvania, the African-American journalist convicted of killing a police officer in 1981. Many say that his trial was unfair and that he deserves a new one. He's been on death row for some 17 years right now. We spoke to you last when you visited SCI Green in Pennsylvania, and you also visited Mumia Abu-Jamal. I know that there is a controversy raging within Amnesty International about how to categorize Mumia Abu-Jamal. Amnesty International is known for choosing prisoners of conscience, also deciding whether someone is a political prisoner. What category does Mumia Abu-Jamal fall in for Amnesty International?
Amnesty International has been campaigning and will continue to campaign to spare the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We do not want Mumia Abu-Jamal to be executed. We think that there are some disturbing elements in his trial, and certainly in the sentencing part of his trial, which continue to raise concern when we review the proceedings and when we review the trial. Now, the controversy regarding the category of political prisoner, prisoner of conscience within Amnesty or between Amnesty and other organizations, to a certain extent, is not really relevant here. I think what the human rights community has to rally around is the need to spare the life of Mumia. If we spare his life, then that will give him and his supporters the opportunity to continue the fight to have his trial reopened if necessary. But at the moment, our concern, and when I met with Mumia Abu-Jamal, that is what I discussed with him, that our campaigning at the moment is that we make sure that we spare his life. Because there may be some complacency there, people believing or thinking that, no, Mumia will never be executed, he's too famous, or he has an international network of supporters that the state will never dare, etc., etc. But I think that that complacency could lead to a lack of decisive action, the mobilization to ensure that the death sentence is overturned is a must, and for us that's the priority.
Is he considered a political prisoner by Amnesty?
Amnesty International, that is, you have around the world hundreds of thousands of political prisoners, and really our focus is on prisoners of conscience. Mumia Abu-Jamal, his trial certainly, and the prosecution when they laid the ground for the accusation, certainly they brought issues of his belonging to the Black Panther Party when he was younger, etc., which was totally irrelevant to the case. It is certainly true that there have been political motivations behind the prosecution of Mumia Abu-Jamal. So yes, he is a political prisoner, but for us political prisoners are a category for whom we are concerned regarding instances of torture together with other prisoners, regarding the fairness of the trial. And in that respect, we have reviewed the trial, and at this stage it is difficult for us, apart from the sentencing, to finalize it yet. We are still in the process of looking at the issue.
Pierre Sané, we do have to wrap up, but I want to give people an opportunity to get the report. Where can they go on the web and phone number?
So on the website, it's www.rightsforall-usa.org.
That's www.rightsforall-usa.org. And a phone number?
The phone number of the New York office is 212-807-8400. And from the New York office, they will be given the telephone number of the regional offices in Atlanta, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Washington and Boston.
That again, that number in New York, 212-807-8400. Well, I want to thank you very much, Pierre Sané, Secretary General of Amnesty International, for joining us today. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Joe Gill engineered from Washington, D.C. Julie Drizin's our executive producer, Michelle Garcia, our webmeister. Our website is www.pacifica.org. And shout out today to my father. It is his 70th birthday. Happy birthday, Dad. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.
Paul and Silas began to shout.